Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The cost of processing all your debit card transactions doesn't sound nearly as interesting as what the merchants have labeled the added expense. It's no accident they call them swipe fees. The banks have been screaming about plans to put a cap on what they can charge, and today banking authorities agreed to take a kinder, gentler approach. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, monitoring, protecting, and improving reputations online while deleting personal data from the Internet. Reputation.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdal. Glad you can join us this Wednesday, the 29th of June. Well, they say a journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step, which explains how the banks have been able to collect $15 billion per year through tiny charges merchants pay every time you break out the plastic. That's changing today. The Federal Reserve Board of Governors has decided to cap so-called swipe fees at 21 cents. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith joins us now to talk about what this will mean both for banks and for merchants. Hey, Stacey.
Hi, Bob.
So give me a sense of how big these fees have been on merchants and what difference today's decision is going to make.
Well, the fees vary, actually, depending on your bank and the size of your purchase. But the average charge is about 44 cents per debit card swipe, which might not sound like a lot, but the banks take in about $15 billion in swipe fees every year. Now, the Fed is going to cap that at about 20 cents per swipe.
Now, I understand the Fed originally planned to cap it at around 10 cents. Now we're talking just a dime or two less per transaction. Is that really such a big deal?
Yes, they did originally say they were going to cap it at 10 cents, but the banks made a lot of noise about it. The Fed got thousands of comments, so it compromised and will cap the fees at 20 cents. And it is actually a pretty big deal. It's going to take a big chunk out of the $15 billion the banks were taking in. And what's more, the banks now say they'll lose money on every transaction. They say every time you swipe your debit card, it costs them about 27 cents, which is higher than the cap. Just FYI, though, the Fed did their own calculation and says the bank only pays about 4 cents per swipe, which would still leave room for a pretty healthy profit for the banks.
I'd imagine this is a perfect compromise here. Neither side happy?
That is exactly right. The merchants aren't happy the Fed raised that cap. In fact, one of the big groups I talked with, the Merchant Payments Association, is threatening legal action. Merchants say the fees are still crippling and force them to jack up their prices. And the banks aren't happy either. Restrictions on overdraft fees and now this swipe fee cap are basically going to mean debit cards are just a lot less profitable. Gilles Baratius analyzes the debit card industry for Celent, and he thinks this cap is going to mean big changes for our debit cards.
This would make debit card economics as they are right now profitable for a lot of the companies. But I don't think it will mean the end of the debit cards, but I think debit cards will have to be more tightly integrated with the rest of the bank account proposition.
Basically meaning that if you do a certain amount of business with the bank, you get a free debit card, otherwise you pay. We can also probably expect fees, especially for debit cards that are attached to rewards programs.
But how do they make up $15 billion in fees?
The banks are actually finding new ways to make money from debit cards. One of the most interesting ones is they're starting to sell the data they have from our debit purchases. They know what we buy, and they can sell that information to merchants. And the merchants can use that information to advertise to us. That could actually be just as profitable to the banks as swipe fees.
Figuring out another way to get money from the merchants, the great circle of commerce. Stacey Vanek-Smith, thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Wall Street makes it 3 winning days. Details when we do the numbers. A big name bank and a big figure financial settlement today. Bank of America says it'll pay $8.5 billion to settle claims from major investors over mortgage-backed securities gone bad. They were sold by Countrywide Financial, which B of A bought at the beginning of the financial crisis. Investors like MetLife, BlackRock, and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York claim they were sold shaky mortgages with lousy collateral. Now B of A is trying to get past all that. Question is, what does it do for the rest of us? Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
Bank analysts see the settlement as evidence B of A is moving past all its legal troubles. And that's good news for anyone who owns B of A stock. Paying out $8.5 billion will eat up several years of recent profits, but it's just pennies on the dollar of the disputed bond's original value. Chris Whalen at Institutional Risk Analytics, though, predicts years of lawsuits to come.
I don't see this as the high watermark at all. I think it's an indication of how much more expense all of these big banks are going to face as a result of litigation.
Settlements like this one, though, might help distressed homeowners, says Guy Sakala of Inside Mortgage Finance. That's because investors charge banks are sloppy with their paperwork, both in writing mortgages and also foreclosing on them.
Potentially, this lays the groundwork for other people, perhaps even consumers, going after Bank of America, Wells Fargo, or any of the major servicers for servicing problems.
And if investors start settling with banks and clearing their books of bad loans, they might start buying new mortgage-backed securities, says Sakala, which would get more money flowing into the pipeline to lend to potential home buyers.
And that would help borrowers who traditionally have gone after non-conforming mortgages, whether they be jumbo mortgages or to people with smaller down payments or less than perfect credit.
Of course, those are some of the same people whose shaky mortgages sent the economy spiraling into chaos in the first place. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
If you think about it, Google is kind of like a math whiz who is knowledgeable on searching the web with fancy algorithms, but weak on social skills. For 7 years now, the company has been struggling to get a social network off the ground. It launched Wave, which no one could understand. Google Buzz set off all sorts of privacy alarms. And Orkut. Yeah, who ever heard of that? Today, it's trying once more, just as MySpace is finally being unloaded at fire sale prices by News Corp. Google is trying again to face off against Facebook, this time with something it's calling Google Plus. Marketplace's Steve Henn takes a look.
Google Plus offers social feeds and lets you post pictures. It pushes news or videos your way that Google thinks you might like. So here's the plus. It lets you group your friends into circles and control what they see. Stephen Levy is author of Inside the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives.
Every time you share something on Facebook, unless you really work hard to limit it, you pretty much have to share it with everyone or no one at all.
Okay, so limits on oversharing. The other pluses? A 10-way video chat called Hangout. There's also something called Huddle, which lets you message a group of friends all at once. But will all these little pluses add up to the millions of users Google needs to succeed as a social network?
Well, I think Google Plus is perhaps the most promising of all the things Google has rolled out so far. Of course, that's faint praise, given all of the flops.
Josh Burnoff's at Forrester Research. He and Levy says Google execs are terrified they've missed the social wave. Americans now spend more time on Facebook than any other site, and advertisers there know exactly who they're talking to.
Google is not in its comfortable position of throwing a lead pass and going where no one else is, but chasing taillights, as one executive called it.
Google's intent on not being left behind. So today at Google, every single employee's bonus, no matter what the job, is tied to the company's success going social. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
President Obama had a message for Congress today as he faced reporters at the White House. He challenged Republicans to go along with eliminating certain tax breaks for the super wealthy.
The revenue we're talking about isn't coming out of the pockets of middle-class families that are struggling. It's coming out of folks who are doing extraordinarily well and are enjoying the lowest tax rates since before I was born.
At the same time, the president urged lawmakers to extend his tax cuts for middle-income Americans. He pressed Congress to raise the debt ceiling, and he says there's an important way lawmakers can help put more Americans back to work.
Right now, Congress can advance a set of trade agreements that would allow American businesses to sell more of their goods and services to countries in Asia and South America.
That may be one way to get more people back on the payrolls. Commentator Robert Reich has another idea. Work on increasing demand for goods and services here at home.
What to do about raging unemployment? Many Republicans and a few Democrats are peddling supply-side solutions. Cut corporate taxes, reduce the cost of capital, cut the employer's share of payroll taxes. This is nonsense. The problem is not on the supply side. Companies don't need financial incentives to hire. They're sitting on $1.9 trillion of cash. They don't even know what to do with it all. If they wanted to use this cash to hire additional workers, they could. Instead, they're buying back their own stock and buying other companies. Nor is the cost of capital an issue. Capital is cheap. Companies can get bargain basement interest rates on new loans. Nor does it make any sense to lower the employer's share of payroll taxes. This won't create jobs. Payroll taxes are not deterring companies from adding employees. Let's get real. The problem is on the demand side. It doesn't make economic sense for businesses to hire more workers unless businesses have more customers, and they don't. These days, consumers are reluctant to buy. That's because their real wages are falling, their home values are plummeting, they're still under a huge debt load, and they're worried about keeping their jobs. Supply-side solutions have nothing to do with any of this. They're like pushing wet noodles. The economy needs a boost on the demand side. For 30 years now, we've been hearing from supply-side economists say that if we reduce tax rates on the rich and on corporations and keep the cost of capital low, we'll get more jobs and growth, and the benefits will trickle down to everyone else. Well, we've tried the theory out, and little or nothing has trickled down. Tax revenues are now 15% of the national economy. That's the lowest in 60 years, and capital is cheaper than ever. But the economy is going nowhere. Can I be blunt? It's the demand side, stupid.
Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. His most recent book is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Next week, David Frum. Send us your comments at marketplace.org. Coming up, state budgets are strapped. So how to handle the growing demand for health coverage?
One of the ways to look at it is virtually every new dollar coming into a state is going to go to Medicaid.
But first, let's do the numbers. Greece's new austerity package helped boost spending on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 0.6% or 72 points to close at 12,261. The Nasdaq picked up 0.4% or 11 points to end at 2740. The S&P 500 turned up 0.8%. That's 10 points. It wrapped up at 1307. That Bank of America settlement we told you about was good news to financial firms who don't like uncertainty. B of A collected nearly 3%. Citigroup deposited 3.33%. Goldman Sachs moved up 2.5%. BJ's Wholesale Club agreed to be acquired for nearly $3 billion, and investors bought in bulk. BJ's shares jumped 4.5%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, offering retirement and 401k plans to businesses for more than 60 years. MassMutual.com/retirestrong. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Farmers Insurance, trained local agents committed to small business success. More at 1-866-200-4BIZ. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
from the Marketplace Datebook. Here's a glance at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Senate Finance Committee discusses deficit reduction. The National Education Association, or NEA, annual meeting gets underway in Chicago. And get a grip! It's National Handshake Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdal. Walmart has come up with a new loss leader to get shoppers into its stores: cheaper gas. Customers can knock a dime off every gallon as long as they pay with a Walmart credit card or a reloadable Walmart gift card or money card. In other words, you're likely to step inside the store to get the discount. The offer is good through September in 18 Heartland states, although not in the Northeast, Florida, or the West Coast. Even without Walmart's help, prices at the pump keep falling. So much for that scare talk about $5 a gallon gasoline. Marketplace's Scott Tong is here with a status report from Washington. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Bob.
So what happened to this gas-mageddon that we were anticipating? I spent $3.60 a gallon here in Southern California just this past weekend.
I got you beat, Bob. You know, Sunday I sent my fifth grader to summer camp, and I tell you, somewhere near Fredericksburg, Virginia, $3.29.
So whoa.
Drive on over, and I'll show you. I'm sure it's worth it for you.
I'll think about it.
Nationally, gas prices have tumbled about 24 cents this past month. And the biggest factor in gas prices is crude oil prices, which fell about 7% in the past week. And we know what happened this last week. The IEA, the International Energy Agency, that is the non-OPEC producers, and the U.S. said they were going to open the spigot, release a small amount of their rainy day stockpiles into the market. So if you're buying anything and you see more of anything on the market, more Oreos on the shelf, more oil in the market, you figure prices are going to fall. Now, here's the thing about oil and gas. The new supplies aren't even on the shelf yet. They're just taking bids today. But Mark Rout at energy consultancy KBC, he told me that oil and gas station markets, they react instantly.
Gasoline prices move virtually in lockstep with crude prices. So if there's an announcement that the IEA is making available extra crude end products on the market discounts that news immediately because the market works in advance. It works typically 30 days in advance.
Now, of course, there's always a tug of war when it comes to gas prices, Bob. There's news today that American stockpiles may be down a little bit, so you never know. But the smart money seems to think we may see a fairly moderate summer at the pump.
So are we going to then go back to our gas hogging ways here, back to the big SUVs circa 2007, if that's the case?
I talked to several energy analysts today, and roughly zero of them think that's going to happen. In fact, all of them think U.S. demand has actually peaked for good. We're not talking about peak oil supply, but peak North American demand. If you look at the numbers, total vehicle miles have maxed out, our commuting distances too, and perhaps most important, our cars are getting more fuel efficient. And this next model year, it's going to be even more so because of new rules for fuel economy. There's one economist in Calgary named Peter Terzakian, and he uses the phrase energy obesity. And, you know, it's not like we Americans are particularly svelte at 19 million barrels a day, but it seems our gorging behavior seems to have topped out.
So it seems that we are then changing our habits. We're slimming down. I wonder, does that feed on itself? Is it going to reduce demand for oil and then bring prices down?
That'd be negative, Bob. Oil, of course, is a global thing. It's subject to global supply, global demand. And the biggest piece of the demand story, it ain't us. It's China doing what we did back in the 20th century, moving to the cities, buying their first car, driving to work, and wouldn't you know it, they buy a lot of Buicks. So in nerd speak, they're the crude oil price makers, and we're the price takers. And some analysts think the Chinese will keep buying even if oil prices go up 30%. So that's in the neighborhood of $125 a barrel, $4.50 a gallon here in the States.
Mm-hmm. I saw just today crude spiked $2 a barrel, so I'm not going to rush out and start spending my savings at the pump just yet, Scott. That's just me being cautious, though.
I guess don't expect a $2 gallon ever again is what the pros are telling me.
Marketplace's Scott Tong, thanks.
You're welcome.
It's a Wednesday, so how about we check the inbox?
I'm going to sit right down and and write myself a letter.
Politicians in Washington aren't the only ones looking to strike a spending deal. As the fiscal year closes, states are still scrambling to solve shortfalls. In a moment, we'll hear how Missouri officials are handling their budget woes. Last week, we looked at Connecticut, where the Public Employees Union voted down a proposed reduction in pensions. Judith Simon of Saugerties, New York, says our coverage of the vote lacks something important, an explanation of why union members rejected the proposal.
Was it that millionaires and billionaires in the state are not contributing their fair share? Was it that union members had already accepted cuts for the past few years? Was it that their pensions were already rock bottom? What was the reason? I have no idea.
As we pointed out in our story, it was actually a minority of union workers who voted to hold out for a better deal, but the majority who voted to accept the cuts fell short of the threshold required to approve the deal. Airlines are trying once again to board passengers onto planes faster. Several of you wrote in to say the biggest holdup is people with carry-on luggage. Here's Allison Nodgman of Durham, North Carolina.
Ever since it was no longer free to check bags or even a reasonable price, in my humble opinion, most of the airline boarding delays I've experienced have been due to flight attendants trying to play Tetris with bags in the overhead bins. How much would the time decrease if the bag fees were $10 or even $5? I bet that's an experiment the airlines aren't willing to try.
And finally, farm and food officials met in Paris last week to discuss ways to reduce global food prices. One proposal, crack down on commodity speculation. Sarah Cavage from Seattle says such hedging is far from legitimate. She's traveling, so she voiced her comment through her computer for us.
Wall Street has recently decided that commodities are a good investment, just like they did with mortgages. And just like the mortgage crisis, this is wreaking havoc on the normal functioning of commodities markets and food prices. Plus, Wall Street deals in volumes that were unheard of before, and they are the market movers now.
We want to hear from you. Send us your letters at marketplace.org. Just click on the link that says Contact. A federal stimulus program to help stabilize state budgets is coming to a close tomorrow. The government provided some $90 billion in emergency funds to get state governments past collapsing tax revenues and help pay for such services as education and health care. Now, states are having to slash spending. But here's the catch with cuts. As Adam Ellington reports from St. Louis Public Radio, with some programs, their hands are tied.
Before the economic meltdown in 2008, Missouri brought in tax revenues of $8 billion. But the recession and sluggish recovery have taken their toll. Last year, tax receipts fell 16% to just over $6.5 billion. Over the past 2 years, the federal government helped Missouri close that tax gap with $3 billion in stimulus funds. The money went mostly to prevent massive layoffs in K-12 education and to provide health care through the state's Medicaid program. Come Friday, that money will be gone, and Missouri has had to make some tough budget choices to make up the difference. One of the losers has been higher education.
Yeah, there's a tendency for state governments to view higher education as the budget balancer.
Tom George is the chancellor of the University of Missouri, St. Louis, the state's third largest campus. Opening the blinds in his office, he points to the school's aging science center, which in 2007 had been earmarked for $30 million in upgrades.
And if we can't say it because of the trees, but it's our oldest academic building on the campus. It's not glamorous kinds of funding. It's renovation. It's fixing up things behind the walls.
Those plans are on hold now, and George has seen his campus funding slashed by $7 million. He's had to make that up through layoffs, increased tuition, and fewer class offerings.
You know, I suppose you can say, well, we can eliminate that major, we can eliminate that major. Well, before you're done, suddenly you don't have what looks like a university. You don't have that experience that the students should have.
Higher education and other programs had to take bigger cuts because one program, Medicaid, couldn't be cut. States are required under federal law to maintain Medicaid spending in order to qualify for federal matching funds. This year, the program will account for a full 30% of Missouri's state budget. Linda Lubreen is the Missouri State Budget Director. She says Medicaid enrollment is climbing steadily.
The biggest percentage of our Medicaid budget really is used to cover low-income seniors and people with disabilities. And that's not driven by the economic situation. nearly as much as it's just growth of our senior population and the number of people with disabilities.
Like Missouri, states around the country can only watch as Medicaid crowds out other areas of state spending. Scott Pattison is the director of the National Association of State Budget Officers.
One of the ways to look at it is virtually every new dollar coming into a state is going to go to Medicaid. In fact, we forecast that Medicaid is the only significant area of state government that's going to increase.
But that's not to say Medicaid has escaped program cuts. States are looking to restrict eligibility and reduce services to help rein in rising health care costs. Missouri's already cut back home visits for patients with chronic conditions. Last year, 160,000 people were eligible. This year, just 3,400 are. Susan Menhard worries her own services could be next.
My understanding is that it could be slashed at any time.
Menhard has been paralyzed from the neck down since a gymnastics accident in 2001. She receives 11 hours of daily in-home care, paid for through Medicaid. If her benefits were cut, Menhard says she'd be forced into a nursing home. With the in-home care, she's independent and holds down a part-time job without burdening her family.
You know, it makes me feel like I have an identity, you know, like I'm a citizen again instead of just this big, oversized baby, you know, that somebody needs to take care of.
All told, nearly 15% of Missourians are on Medicaid, but the working poor barely register in that figure. To qualify, adults in Missouri can't make more than 18% of the federal poverty index, or just $3,500 a year. In St. Louis, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by FreshBooks, an online invoicing service for freelancers and small businesses designed to help save time, look professional, and make invoicing easy. More at FreshBooks.com. By Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time. On the web at Putnam.com/large cap equity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A final note, what makes you happier? Watching a good TV show? Or how about surfing the web? Or just maybe a good radio broadcast? From Great Britain comes a study which finds people who listen to the radio report a 100% lift in happiness and a 300% boost to their energy levels versus not consuming any type of media at all. They also get a lift watching TV or being online, but nowhere near as much as the effect they say radio has on their outlook and well-being. Okay, I guess it's worth noting, but so what if the survey was commissioned by Britain's Radio Advertising Bureau? And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 0.6% or 72 points. The Nasdaq picked up 0.4%, 11 points. The S&P 500 turned up 0.8%, that's 10 points. Fahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time, a tale of two aspens, one rich, one poor.
When your community costs four times that of the average American city, you have to subsidize the working population.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join Kai for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.